Say, Nancy.
Yes, Gabe.
I have something for you. All right.
You are my new best friend.
Where's that? Can you describe what it is?
I can tell you that Gabe just handed me a package of Goldenberg's peanut chews. Peanut chews are my childhood favorite candy. And this is something that if you grew up in Philadelphia or anywhere in that area, these were local candy. And in fact, the factory was in the neighborhood I grew up in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The Goldenberg's mothership?
That's right.
Had landed in Nancy's neighborhood. So I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect. And I'm talking, of course, with Nancy Leeson, our food commentator. And these Goldenberg's peanut chews, can you describe them? What are they? Like, what is inside of
them?
Well,
I'm going to open this up. The hell with describe. I'm just going to open it up and have a bite of it so you can hear it, I think.
By all means.
There's peanuts and molasses covered in dark chocolate.
So we're getting to the crux of it here, Nancy. What does that make you feel, taking a bite of that?
Well, it reminds me of Golden Slipper Camp. In the summer, when my sisters and my brother and I would get sent off to overnight camp in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania, these were the treats that were frequently given to us. And because it was such a wonderful experience for me over the years going to Golden Slipper, I always associate this chocolate candy with the happier parts of my childhood.
Now, you know they're, like, disgusting, right? They're gross.
These?
Yeah.
Because you looked to see what was in them?
Well, they proudly say on the package that they originated as a World War One ration bar.
You know, I don't know if it says that on the package, but
it does.
I think
it's
that,
on the
does it really?
Honest to goodness.
Well, but you can see why, right?
But I think the point of comfort food is that it comforts regardless of whether it is tasty to eat, right? It's about the evocation of something from the past.
I think that that's true for so many of us. It's the one thing that makes me feel happy. I'd rather commune with a bowl of a dumpling noodle soup when I'm by myself than with anyone. I don't like to have company.
But in general, or when you're having comfort food?
When I'm having comfort food. And I think that's true for a lot of us who sneak comfort foods that perhaps, like Cheetos might be your comfort, not yours, I presume.
Let's say it's not.
Okay, let's say it's not.
Well, I would like to try a peanut chew.
Have actually. You never had one?
No, I've judged them from afar, but I haven't actually tasted one. Here we go. Okay. I'll be back in about 10 minutes when I'm done chewing it.
Okay.
There's probably nothing grosser than hearing somebody chew on a recording. It's like a Snickers bar with even more mysterious goop in the middle.
It's like a Snickers bar with really good goop in the middle. Says me, eating another one.
Well, thank you for that, Nancy Leeson. We've been talking about comfort food. And you can find out all the Sound Effect team's favorite comfort foods by going to kplusoundeffect.org. And maybe you could tell us your own while you're there. This week on Sound Effect, we are taking stock of our comfort zones and telling some stories of people who left them. Stick around for that right after our panel of experts goes over the week's news from the comforts of our studios. Don't go away. We are back in the saddle with three very clever journalists to help hash out the week's top story and to talk about our underreported stories of the week. I am joined this week by Josh Veit, who's political editor of Seattle Met Magazine and founder and editor of Publicola. Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor at the Northwest News Network, and Kyle Stokes is youth and education reporter for a little outfit called KPLU. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, Gabe.
So glad to have you back. Of course, I don't see how this week's top story could be anything but, you know, the first dinosaur fossil found in Washington State. But cooler heads have prevailed. I've been persuaded that tens of thousands of teachers walking out of their classrooms to protest underfunding of education is more important, or at least more interesting to normal people. So we're going to talk that over a little bit. Why don't we start with you, Kyle? You were out there in the throngs of red-shirted teachers here in Seattle. It also included teachers from Mercer Island and Issaquah. What was it like? Can you just kind of give us a flavor?
It was, honestly, like, the thing I would compare it to is it was sort of like being at May Day Not the like the part with the rioting and the throwing of things and the police barricades and stuff like that, but like the officially sanctioned march in the morning. That's, you know, on May Day it's about immigrant and worker rights, and on Tuesday it was about education issues. And of course the unions wanted to bill this as being about pay and benefits and class sizes. They're really mad that the lawmakers in Olympia are not fully funding the class size initiative that voters approved to reduce class sizes in Washington State. But there were so many other issues tacked onto it. And like at May Day, it isn't just about workers and immigrant rights. It's about a lot of different issues that sort of surround it.
Well, of course, Seattle's the state's biggest district and a bunch of other districts walking out this week as well. But there's more than 60 statewide. Phyllis, do you get a sense of whether it's a similar picture elsewhere in the state?
Yeah, you know, they had some walkouts in Tri-Cities on Thursday. And, you know, the big pressure point with this kind of thing is always, you know, at least the concern for the day is childcare and how big of an issue is that. I would say that in all the cities that I've looked at so far and the ones coming up like Spokane, so far I would say that the PR battle is being won by the teachers on this by far, because they planned the walkout so far in advance. The weather happens to be nice. It's only one day. I had to dig pretty deep to find someone saying, you know, how dare you use our children for your politics?
So here's my question. It's a balancing act when you're doing something like this. You want to be disruptive enough to get attention, but not disruptive enough as to engender a backlash. They want parents and school districts to stay on their side. So do you have a sense of like where they have landed on that continuum?
You know, obviously the Republicans tried to call them out for having an illegal strike and tried to frame that conversation to make the teachers and the teachers union the bad guy. I haven't done any polling. I don't know that the Republicans won that battle. My personal take is that the teachers are winning the PR battle. It's hard at this point, given the context of McCleary, that education, K-12 education funding, is just been such a big issue, and the Supreme Court is wagging its finger, and that's about all they're doing, at the state legislature, that I think the teachers doing a walkout, I think it looks bold. I think the Republicans looked small-minded on that.
Although, you know, the Seattle Times is one that's wagged its finger on its editorial page, and a few others have made the point that all three budget plans in play, the Democrats, the Republicans, and Governor Inslee's, do have big increase, well, you know, a relatively big increase for education spending, more than $1 billion. There are provisions to reduce class size for at least K-3. So how much can they move the needle at this point? Are we talking about just the difference between $1.3 billion and $1.5 billion? Or K-3 even versus K-5 for cutting class size down?
I think that if you want to look at just the issues that the union bills these protests as being about, then there are wins to be gotten from these walkouts. If you're concerned about making sure that the way that teacher benefits are handled stays the way it is, and maybe, like the Democrats have proposed, increase the state's contribution to healthcare premiums, if you want to cement a larger cost of living raise into the final budget, then this walkout might be effective at doing that. But the issue is that there's a disconnect between the discrete issues where they can affect change right now versus things like the class size initiative that was practically dead on arrival after it was passed for all political, practical intents and purposes. And I think if awareness is the issue, it put a human face finally on this McCleary decision. You saw, you know, my kid's teacher was out there on the corner, and now I understand at least who's affected by this. I'm not sure that necessarily translates into the kind of multi-billion. I mean, it literally would take probably another $2 billion to fund things like the class size initiative fully.
Well, one thing I just want to address is you were talking about the PR battle. And Kyle, you brought this up, but one thing that the union is I think, losing on the PR battle is, you said it was dead on arrival, correct? The funding for class size initiative. And that's right. The question that the teachers didn't answer is the one that the legislature hasn't answered, and then the one that the court is asking is, how do you fund this? And all they passed was, fund this. And I think when you pass an unfunded mandate and the legislature turns its back on you and says, well, we're dealing with the same issue, there's some resistance to the union saying, fund us, without giving a solution. So how much better of a job are the unions doing than the legislature? And I would add, you know, when you talk to the teachers union, well, they're supportive of the capital gains tax. They're supportive of some of these democratic solutions. Well, then why didn't they put that on the ballot? Why did they just put up fund it on the ballot? Because they knew that would pass, and they knew some of these other solutions are controversial.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for that discussion of our top story. Well, it's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, joined by Kyle Stokes of KPLU, Phyllis Fletcher of the Northwest News Network, and Josh Veit of Seattle Met Magazine and Publicola. Now we're going to move into our underreported stories of the week. And Josh, maybe you could get us launched here. What's your underreported story?
Well, I think that there were some endorsements in this year's Seattle City Council races, and big endorsements from two kind of weather vane groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the sort of evil establishment group, and the Sierra Club, the lefty environmentalist group, which, you know, their message is broader than just saving trees. It's become about density and urbanism, so it's really kind of germane in Seattle City politics from a progressive point of view. And what I found interesting and that wasn't reported beyond just the main report was here's who's the Chamber's endorsed, here's who the Sierra Club's endorsed. What was missing from that analysis is there was quite a bit of overlap. Out of the six candidates that both groups endorsed, they went the same way in three races. My point here is that there is this conceit, there's this kind of soundbite analysis about Seattle City Council elections where there's the establishment and there's the upstart renegades who are want to throw the bums out. And I think that's too simple, and I think Seattle politics are more nuanced than that, and I think you found that in these endorsements. What's been frustrating to me about covering the city for years is this simplistic dichotomy between establishment. I mean, establishment, you know, this is a city that is ahead on marijuana legalization, is ahead on wage inequality. So it's funny when people talk about the evil establishment in Seattle.
All right. I appreciate your keen eye trained on the city council elections because it is a lot to keep track of. All right, Phyllis Fletcher, what's your undercover story?
I feel silly now. But Mama's Mexican Kitchen is closing. Oh. That's so sad.
That is not a trivial thing in this shop. You know, Mama's, good. We call it our second newsroom a little bit.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. You have a few Cadillac margaritas at lunch?
Perhaps. Well, so for somebody who lives in Mukilteo or something, like tell them what is Mama's and who cares about it?
It's been on 2nd and Bell in Belltown for 41 years. And the owner of the building and the restaurant just finally got an offer that he was like, you know, I'm ready to retire. I got to take it. And I understand that. The thing that stood out to me, though, is, I mean, I don't know that much about commercial real estate, but for something in the heart of Belltown, $4.5 million seemed low to me. Oh. Am I crazy? I mean, I don't know. It seemed...
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a game-changing amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, for one person's life, it's absolutely game-changing. I just hope that he had people advising him and that's what it's really worth. And I am sad to see it go.
All right. Well, we'll bid it a fond farewell. Kyle, can you bring it on home for us? What's your undercover story?
Yeah, I think to bring it back full circle to what we started talking about here is education issues. I think that the funding piece is only, you know, like how much money do we add to our education budget? That's only part of the decision. The other part is the part that nobody is talking about right now. You know, it's been very undercover, in my opinion, and that's the overhaul of the local property tax levy system. This is the heart of a lot of the issues that kind of plague our schools right now. It's at the heart of the McCleary ruling itself, which is, and it's been a problem for decades, basically, the fact that there is a difference between high property value districts and low property value districts. The reason I bring this up as undercovered is because if we want to talk about throwing money at education, I mean, pumping money into education as per laws that were passed in the past, that's one thing. Fixing the system going forward is another, and there seems to be no energy behind either fixing the problem or talking about the problem in the legislature and in the press.
All right, well, we'll fix it here around this table. Kyle Stokes is our youth and education reporter here at KPLU. Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor for the Northwest News Network, and Josh Veit is political editor for Seattle Met Magazine and founder and editor of Publicola. Thank you guys so much for being on Sound Effect.
Yeah.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. And today we're deconstructing our comfort zones, how we build them, how we stretch them, and sometimes how we escape them. So many of us have had some version of this really uncomfortable nightmare. You're either at work or you're at school. You're probably about to take a test or give a presentation or something. And then you realize you aren't naked. Well, Robert Treat has the exact opposite dream.
I would be sleeping and I would be thrashing, saying, they can't see me. They can't draw me. This is terrible. I have this stuff on me. Why do I have this blanket on me? They can't see me. It was the opposite. I'm on stage and naked. I literally was feeling that, I must be modeling in my head somewhere, and I'd be waking up trying to get the blankets off me, going, well, they can't see me. Why am I having this stuff on? So I was dreaming that I was clothed at work.
Yeah.
And it would wake me up. It stressed me, so it would wake me up then.
You had anxiety dreams about going to work with clothes on.
Something my dream.
For the last 35 years, Robert Treat's job has been nude model. And here's the interesting thing about Robert. Not only is stripping down in front of a bunch of art students completely within his comfort zone, he has a hard time imagining how it wouldn't be. He has this way of talking about it that makes you feel like, well, of course it's normal to be naked at work. Maybe I am the weird one in my business casual. So I asked him about what it feels like being exposed in a classroom, and he immediately flipped it, and he explained how it's the art students who are the vulnerable ones.
They got the page in front of them, and they have their own art right there. They have their own exposure of every line. They're naked to the page or something, but it stares back at them, and they're being tortured by their own work, not looking as good as I do in the nude. He looks so good, in my drawing, and they're tortured. So their focus is more on their pain, I think, than mine.
So it's their vulnerability as a young artist, probably an artist who's not very sure of her or himself, mirrors your vulnerability as a naked model in some ways.
Well, they're much more vulnerable than me, I think. I mean, I have the power in the room. The naked person in the room is pretty powerful. Everybody pay attention to them. I mean, everybody's watching me under this setting, but anywhere else, if you started running and telling the room what to do, everybody I guess would do it. Dogs are probably afraid of naked people. I don't know about being vulnerable. I'm the power. Everything's coming off me. I'm the center. I'm the speaker, the silent speaker, whatever. It's all coming from me. There's no weakness there.
But a lot of people are self-conscious about their bodies. If you pay attention to pop culture, it seems like everybody's self-conscious about his or her,
right.
her body. And whether you're, going out somewhere with no shirt on or you're in a public shower or whatever, we have occasions to sort of, wonder about how other people see us and maybe not feel so great about it, a lot of us.
Yeah.
So is that not a part of your experience?
In that setting of the artists, not much. Elsewhere, I would be undersized, skinny, small chested, small. I'm small, sinewy, very underweight. But that's what makes me good for the art, is because I have all the various tissues that show. So I have all my bone points and sticking through my skin, and the connective tissue all shows. And so I'm really kind of, if you put me against the guy in the gym next to you, I'd probably look pretty scrawny. I look like the scrawny guy, but in the art thing, it works.
So what is the most uncomfortable part of the job?
Really, the physical discipline is really the hard part, because it's just a matter of pounds and ounces and gravity. It's all strategies of how to sit in interesting ways and make angles with the lights and where the people are, and depending on the lesson that's going on. To pick something that can survive the amount of time they want. 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10, 15, 20, 2 days.
Do you have strategies for that? I mean, have you gotten into any kind of like meditation or anything like that to sort of take yourself out of yourself?
It becomes a meditation. Rather than, adapt a practice to it, it becomes a meditation.
To bring it on home a little bit, Robert, I understand that you have never really had a lot of self-consciousness around being nude in front of people. You seem to find that a little bit of a strange question. But I wonder, what do you think is different about you from the majority of people who I would take to be pretty self-conscious about that?
Yeah, I don't know the difference. Must have been in the way I was brought up, I guess. Must have been somehow the cross between my innate me and my instructed me, my learned me. Somehow, I don't know. I guess my family's a little relaxed in general, but I don't have. I'm all alone in this venture.
You never learn to fixate, though, on how other people see your body or wrap your selfhood too much up in it. Is that right?
Apparently, it was not like hardly on my screen. It was more interested what to do with it, how to, you know, things you do with it, how I looked, I guess. As a performer, you know, not that I was naked, but how do I look? How do I look? It's all about how I look. I don't know. I can't even think, focus in on that question to find at heart a very good answer in there, I don't think.
Yeah, I feel like there's a certain gulf that that we can't bridge here, where you just don't see why on earth you should care, or why on earth you should.
Why everybody can't sing? Yeah, I don't know.
Right, there you go. Is that the analogy?
I don't know why those who sing can't imagine not singing, I guess.
That was Robert Treat, a man more comfortable in his own skin than I am. Now we move from a guy who's totally at ease to a woman who is never comfortable. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This week, we're feeling around in our comfort zones. So most of us probably take our general baseline physical comfort for granted. But imagine if something as innocent as a friendly pat on the back caused intense pain. So for people who suffer from fibromyalgia, that is your daily life. It's pain interrupted by brief bursts of relief. Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad sat down with a young woman who lives with this disorder to learn how it's made her think differently about her own comfort zone.
My name is Lauren Jansen, and I'm 24 years old. I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia a few days before my 18th birthday. Fibromyalgia is a central nerve disorder that is characterized by widespread pain, chronic pain. Some people have problems with swallowing, bladder problems, and so the reason why I found out I had it is because I was having sleep problems and I was having a lot of pain in my joints and muscles when I was growing up.
So tell me what you deal with.
My elbows and my forearms are regularly in pain, and my knees and my calf muscles are regularly in pain. And then when I've been working, my hips, and I accidentally yelped the other weekend when somebody pinched me just playfully. It kind of feels like there's tacks attached to their fingers when they pinch me. It feels like they're actually digging into my skin with a sharp object. That shocking pain just lingers and it just spreads.
Do certain things trigger?
Stress. Like, my mom hates telling me about anything that's going on in our family because she knows that it just sends me into a downward spiral, and she tries to avoid telling me things until it's an absolute necessity.
How does stress turn into pain?
Your mind is in charge of your body. So if your mind is sick, then your body, and when you have fibromyalgia especially, is going to follow suit. And I think that goes for anybody. When you're stressed out, you get tired and you get worried and it kind of overwhelms you. But when you have fibromyalgia, it overwhelms all of your senses. It overwhelms all of your nerves. And so pain is just so quick to follow when your mind is in turmoil.
Was there a specific tipping point for you where starting to care about your health really mattered?
Yes. January 2nd of 2012, I was dating somebody who I was very serious about. We had a wedding date set for that year. He got in an extremely serious car accident and almost lost his life. He was helicopter life-flighted to Harborview. He was in a coma. All of his limbs were broken. And I realized I can't let this disorder completely take over my life and expect other people to care for me, because even if I have a husband who's willing to care for me, you never know what's going to happen. And I realized that I was putting all of my worth in the idea of who I could find to take care of me. I realized that I had to do something for myself, and I had to stop letting this disorder take over my life, because I realized if I could get through the pain, the emotional pain of that car accident, really made me realize that I can do more than what I'm doing. At that point, I decided that I was going to enroll myself in college. I was going to start working out. I was going to do things that were hard and that I never thought I would be able to do. That's when I started to feel better. It was when my vision wasn't so cloudy and when I really started to be able to see that I did have purpose and there was a reason that I was here and that I could overcome this disorder and this diagnosis, that I started to actually feel significantly better. I also realized, like, I want it to be worth something. If I'm going to be hurting this bad, I might as well be pushing myself and getting some sort of gain out of it. So I started exercising and I started really pushing myself at the gym because I needed it to be worth something.
You needed the pain to be worth it.
But it takes a lot to get out of those ruts. It takes a lot of focus and a lot of care for yourself in order to get out of those little fibrofogs and the pain, and it's like a whirlwind effect. Like, everything kind of goes at once.
So I can imagine that this is something that could be difficult for friends, people in relationships, to totally understand.
It is. I feel like it's hard to tell somebody that you're sick every few weeks or so and that you're just asking for sympathy maybe. And I feel like sometimes I get treated like I'm lazy or like I'm not carrying my weight. When you try to explain, oh, I have this pain disorder, and they ask more questions because they're curious. They want to know what's going on. And then when they ask, oh, how do you get diagnosed? Well, you get diagnosed by basically excluding all the other options. And so then they get a little bit skeptical, I feel like, and they might not mean to, but I always get these looks like, oh, so you don't know why and you don't know what causes it and it just makes you hurt and that makes your job performance slack a little bit. And just the way that they ask you the questions and the way that it all adds up for them, you can tell they're just like, isn't that convenient? No, it's the most inconvenient thing that's ever happened to me. I hate having to tell my friends birthday weekends that they're all excited about, like, I can't come out. And if I do come out, then I have to go home early because I'm really not feeling good. I don't want people to stop inviting me to these things because I am 24. I'm at my peak. And a lot of times I get to live my life to the fullest, but there are definitely weekends where I have to stay in.
Do you approach relationships differently now than you did in the past?
Oh, yeah. In the past, when I was younger, probably before I started going to college, I dated guys who were just deadbeats. Just, I almost thought I was a deadbeat. I kind of felt like I was a dead-end girlfriend. Like, you're going to have to live a sedentary lifestyle with me. I'm not going to really be available to go hiking. I'm not going to be available to, like, go do crazy fun things and go on adventures with you because of my illness. And I dated men according to my worth. I dated men who I thought weren't worth very much because I didn't think that I was worth very much. And now, it's amazing the people that fall into your life once you start realizing that you actually have a reason to be here and that you have purpose, and once you start living your life to the fullest.
So you talked about this heightened sense of pain. So I have to ask, has having fibromyalgia changed your attitude at all on the idea of becoming a mother someday?
I would have given my entire life to be a mother when I was younger. And now that I'm older, I honestly don't believe I'm gonna have children. I would like to raise a child and give a child an opportunity to have a life that is gonna be the best life that it could possibly have. And I don't think I could give a child that if I give birth to it. Those first few months are so critical and so crucial, and I understand that. And I just don't think that I would be healthy enough to give 100%. It's been one of the hardest realizations for me, and I felt selfish at first. But I believe, if anything, I'm thinking more about the child.
What do you want people to understand about this ailment?
Sometimes people assume that you're doing something to make it worse, and it doesn't necessarily control you, but it's a seesaw. There's days where you're going to be up, and there's days where you're going to be down, and you're going to feel like you can't get up. There's going to be no one on the other side to help you up, and those are the hardest times. And so if you know somebody who has a disorder or a disease or an invisible illness, or they're going through depression, something that you would never be able to see from the outside, something that the world would never be able to tell that they're going through, don't give them your sympathy, give them your love, and give them your presence, and just be in the moment with them and try to help them through it the best that you can.
Lauren Jansen spoke with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestedt. Welcome back to Sound Effect from KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. We're talking about comfort zones today. So imagine heading to Alaska in a small plane. Think about landing on gravel bars and a tundra to camp in really remote parts of the continent. Now imagine doing that knowing that you built the plane yourself. Oh, and you are not, say, a trained engineer. This may sound like something that's way outside of your comfort zone. It's certainly outside of mine, at least. But KPLU's Ashley Gross brings us the story of some folks from Seattle for whom this is just a regular part of life.
For about 11 months of the year, Mark Reed and his wife, Chris Buchanan, live in Ballard. Right, they recently moved into a fixer-upper.
The house is still a work in progress.
The other month of the year, they spend in Alaska. Their home there is a tent they pitch wherever they're able to land their plane. They drink water filtered from a stream. They eat fish they catch themselves. They've been hooked on that wide open space ever since their first trip in 2008.
We were traveling over terrain pretty soon into our trip where we couldn't see a town or a settlement or even a road outside of any of the windows. And that's kind of hard to do in the lower 48.
They let the weather dictate their way. If it's clear, they can make it to places few humans get a chance to go. The northernmost reaches of Alaska, Prudhoe Bay, the Brooks Range, the Colville River. Their means of transportation is kept in a hangar at Payne Field.
And this is the machine.
It's a single-engine prop plane, canary yellow, a bit longer than a Subaru Outback.
And the wings are riveted aluminum here. There's thousands of rivets in there. Lots and lots of hours of riveting.
You did all that?
Oh, yes.
Reed built it from a kit, but added lots of customization, mostly to make the plane safer. He has three GPSs and two electrical systems.
How did it feel the first time you took this plane up? The very first time?
Oh, it was a hoot. You know, there's a certain amount of trepidation. I'd spent almost 3,000 hours building it. I didn't have too many doubts about it, but you are a test pilot, and that first flight is always an exciting one. It's always something to celebrate when it's done.
Reed has always loved making things, especially things that go up in the sky. In college, he taught himself how to make technical, high-end kites, you know, the kind that do flips in the air. He turned that into a business called Prism Designs. About a decade ago, he reached a point where things were going well, but he felt a little bored.
When that happens for me, it's always been helpful to think about, well, what would you be doing if you could be doing anything at all, and time and money was no object. And one day that idea popped into mind, and the idea was to build an airplane and fly it to the northernmost point in Alaska and then fly it down to the southernmost point in South America.
There's an assumption that this is a mad idea that my husband had that I somehow had to be convinced to go along with. And my friends who know me are just as likely to think that the idea came from me.
They share an adventurous spirit. Reed already had his pilot's license, and Buchanan got hers, too. After their first trip, they decided they wanted to go to Alaska every year, and they ditched the South America idea.
We really had our minds blown by the experience of being in that landscape.
2 years after that trip, their daughter was born.
I'm going to take off my tape.
Okay, let's take off your tape. Because it's getting to be time for bed.
When Rachel arrived 5 years ago, did you guys have to have a conversation about, are we going to keep doing this?
No,
I don't think that was not a conversation for us.
They just installed an Evenflo kids car seat in the back of the plane. They rejiggered what they take to accommodate kid gear. Some necessities these days include dum-dum lollipops and a few stuffed animals. The trips are special for Rachel, too.
Do you have a favorite thing about Alaska?
Picking blueberries.
I'm fascinated by that. I have kids, and sometimes I feel almost paralyzed by fear about the dangers that exist. When they climb too high in a tree, I get freaked out. It's hard to imagine taking them to isolated parts of Alaska in a small plane, but I admire it. It's all about teaching kids to jump into life with both feet.
There's something in my tights.
What's
in your tights?
It's bothering my toes. Buchanan and Reed want their daughter to experience how amazing our planet is.
There's something to be said for appreciating the scale of the world that you live in. And it shouldn't be scary. So I think we like taking Rachel out. It's fun camping with her. It's really enjoyable to just spend time out in the tent, listening to the birds and listening to the water and being out in the world.
Making good judgments is another thing they want to teach Rachel. They plan extensively before each flight. That's how they handle the risks of flying in Alaska, the massive mountains, the unforgiving weather.
You spend a lot of time looking pretty far ahead of the airplane, trying to think about what could happen next, what you may be headed towards next, and what you're going to do about it.
That means not just having a plan B, but plans C, D, E, and F. Still, flying's not the only risk. There's also wildlife.
We've seen everything from 50 bears in 20 minutes from a safe distance in the air to bears pretty darn close to our campsite to a bear on the runway in front of the airplane as we were trying to take off. We haven't had any bear encounters that I would call terrifying, but certainly enough to respect them.
One reason they do the trip every year, besides the pure adventure, is to take photos of Reed's kites in spectacular settings, in front of glaciers or aquamarine-colored lakes. Once they caught the attention of a curious caribou that watched from a ways away and then slowly approached them.
That caribou just decided it was time to come and check it out and see what was going on with this colorful thing in the air and these strange bipeds on the ground.
It sounds amazing.
Have you put this on? This is a life vest.
And that's why when Reed asks me if I want to go up with him in his plane, I agree. I'm a little nervous, and I'm kicking myself for not buying life insurance like I've been meaning to. But if it's safe enough for them to take their kid in the plane, I decide to chill out.
It's a survival gear that we typically like to travel with.
Do I need to know how to use this?
Rudimentary stuff. All you really need to know.
We climb into the plane. It's not roomy.
There.
It feels teensy compared to the giant Boeing 777 rolling down the runway before us. I'm feeling pretty calm. I know Reed is a careful guy, but then I see a sign on the dashboard.
I just noticed this passenger warning. This aircraft is amateur built and does not comply with federal safety regulations for standard aircraft.
Reed says, relax. He says the plane actually exceeds a lot of those regulations. We get the go-ahead from the control tower and take off.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
If you're used to flying in a jet, being in a small plane feels almost like you're hardly moving. Reed says we're flying 140 miles per hour. It doesn't feel like it. It's mesmerizing to see Seattle landmarks from above. There's Husky Stadium, there's Gasworks Park. I can see every color of Lake Union in a way that you can't from a boat. Then Reed says, do you want to take the controls? I don't want to be a chicken, but I'm anxious. I lightly push the stick forward and the nose dips. I bank the plane slightly to the right and slightly to the left, and after 30 seconds, I tell him I've had enough. Back on the ground, Reed loads up for a weekend trip. They don't just take their plane to Alaska. They often head to the San Juan Islands. This is a familiar routine. City life is what can feel hard now and then.
Sometimes birthday parties are a little challenging.
Come July, they won't have to worry about a birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese. Instead, they'll be monitoring the weather in Alaska and figuring out good places to land their plane and keeping an eye out for bears.
That story from KPLU's Ashley Gross. For our last guest this week on Sound Effect, we meet a person with a very well-defined comfort zone. It's the space behind 88 piano keys. Whether that's at home or in the dark corner of an old Italian restaurant, KPLU's Ed Ronco brings us the story of Ruby Bishop.
At about 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, Ruby Bishop walks in the door
at Vito's, an Italian restaurant on Seattle's First Hill. Every Sunday, she plays jazz standards here at a Baby Grand in the lounge. She takes off her coat and tosses it behind the piano as a group of regulars walk in. They take a table right in front.
Hello, how goes it?
Hi. Pretty good. Not too hot.
She's played piano all her life. Her career has introduced her to some of the jazz world's greatest names.
I heard some stories that you knew Louis Armstrong.
Louis and I were good friends. And he'd come to my house, and I'd ask the guys in his band what they wanted to eat for dinner, and I'd cook a meal for them. They didn't get much good food when they were on the road.
I talked to Ruby in a couple of places, first at Vito's, and then at her home. I missed her a few times because she was getting over an illness, and that's a bigger deal for her than it might be for you or me.
What's that I hear working around me?
Because Ruby Bishop is 95 years old. You have to picture this. It's really dark in here. There are candles flickering on each table. Ruby is sitting at the piano, which is kind of in a corner underneath a disco ball against two walls with floor-to-ceiling mirrors. She takes requests. She offers a quick thank you to anyone who puts a tip in the glass. And then one of those regulars sitting at the table in front gets up, sits down next to her, and starts to sing. She doesn't mind the company, and she didn't mind the company when I dropped by her house a few days later.
Hello, Ruby. Thanks for having me over.
Oh, glad I could.
How are you?
Oh, I'm better. I think I feel better today than I have in a couple of days.
Good.
The walls of Ruby's living room have pictures of her from throughout the years hanging up. In one of them, she's young, with a beehive hairdo and a delicate necklace. Today, when she plays a gig, she's usually wearing a gray wig and a large string of pearls. As you might expect, there's a baby grand piano in this room, and on the music stand is a black and white photo of a man.
This is my husband after me. This was him first, when I first met him. Wasn't he handsome when he was young?
Yes.
That's the way he was when I met him.
Mm-hmm. Uniform's a nice look for him.
Yeah.
She taps on the photo, and she says they had some great times together. But when I ask her about some of those times, she goes to get a tissue from the bathroom.
When I get into talking about him and all that, I just kind of fall apart, you know?
Back at the piano, yeah. Ruby Bishop gathers herself. Alive when you're behind a piano. You're alive all the time, but you there's something special. Your face changes, and I'm wondering if you can describe how it feels to be behind a piano, to play a piano.
I never thought about it, you know. I don't do it for that. I just go ahead and do what I feel like.
Do you remember the first whole song you learned how to play on the piano?
I can't remember anything anymore. You know, I'm lucky to be alive. I am so lucky to be alive.
As we're sitting there, I ask her about some of her memories, but her voice trails off a little bit. Names, dates, those are sometimes a struggle. And when she struggles, she turns back to the Baby Grand and runs her purple fingernails up the keys.
Tell me a little bit about this piano here.
Well, I just went to Storm bought it.
How long have you had it?
Oh, God, years and years and years. I got three of them, a couple downstairs, and I think they're still down there. I don't know. I haven't been downstairs lately.
When Ruby's at the piano, she's never at a loss for something to say or something to do. So I ask her if the piano gives her strength.
Sometimes, yes. Yes, yes. Yesterday it was. I just came in here and sat down and started playing some things that just made me feel good.
It looks effortless to somebody who doesn't know any better.
Oh, that's good. Oh, yeah. That's a good way of putting it, too, because it's true.
Ruby was born in 1919. She grew up in Rochester and Centralia. She studied to be a beautician, a court reporter. She was a Boeing mechanic during World War II, and she made cabinets for a time. She's played for the troops in South Korea, in Vietnam, and she's performed in Europe and across the United States.
At all.
But now the only place to catch her is Sunday at Vito's.
I'm just wowed by this lady. Like, I just can't believe it. And her fingers are just like, it's like magic.
Kit Tierney is sitting next to me at the bar. She's visiting from out of town.
No, I was just at the hospital because my friend is having cancer surgery. And I walked down to have a beer, and then I saw her, and it's like, wow. You know?
I watch her as she watches Ruby and then scans the room.
You know, look how happy she's making these old people. You know,
like, and these young people.
Well, yeah, and me too. I mean, like middle-aged people, I guess. But, you know, the playing is beautiful, and they're hearing all their favorite songs, some of my favorite songs, and it's just wonderful.
Like every week, some people are listening attentively as they sip Chianti. Others are nodding, tapping their feet as they concentrate on plates of pasta or bruschetta. Some, like Kit, are deeply enamored with what they're witnessing. Others have no idea who's sitting at that piano. Ruby is here for all of them. She plays because she loves it. And because when she's behind those keys, she's right at home.
That story came from KPLU's Ed Ronco. You can see Ruby perform Sunday nights at Vito's on Seattle's First Hill, and we've also posted a picture and linked to a video of her singing on our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. We had reporting this week from Ed Ronco and Ashley Gross, with special thanks to Nancy Leeson. We had web help and nude model logistics help from Mike Lewis. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Lots of stuff on our website this week, kplusoundeffect.org. And that includes the Sound Effect team's favorite comfort foods and an invitation to submit your own. Send your thoughts on the show to soundeffect@kplu.org. Or leave us a gentle review on iTunes, or any review, whatever, we can take it. That's where you can find our podcast, of course. And let's do this again next week. We're going to be knocking around ideas about self-government.
We elected a mayor and a city council and a police chief and an urban planning committee. It was just good fun.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.